I want to first introduce to you Katja Hill, who is the chair of SIG-03, which is the one on AAC, and she will introduce our keynote speaker.
Good morning. This is such an exciting time for me to have a plenary speaker that is representing AAC Assistive Technology. And I want to thank the various SIG-3 members that kind of stimulated and motivated this idea to have a plenary on AAC, and such a special speaker that we have today. And I want to thank Ray for everything that he did to help to organize this. It's been my privilege and honor to have known Mary for several years in her work with USAC, the United States Society for AAC, and as she has transitioned to a more global or international work in ISAC as president-elect of our international society. But more importantly, Mary brings to us an appreciation of individuals that rely on AAC and maximizing their potential to achieve, and what our area of assistive technology can offer, especially with her work with the United Nations. So I'm very much looking forward to her talk on this issue. So, Mary, we welcome you, and we're all friendly here, aren't we?
Thanks, Katja.
Thank you so much for coming.
It's my great privilege and honor to be invited to speak with all of you today. And although my experience and areas of interest have been in augmentative and alternative communication, I deliberately planned a plenary speech a little more global than that, although you will hear me talk about examples from augmentative alternative communication. But basically, in the time we have, I want to have three objectives, and these are written in a more formal way, but basically I want to talk about culture, and I want to introduce a very broad definition of culture as I use it, and I've come to experience it after being in California for 17 years. The second thing is I want to talk about the United Nations Convention and this historical treaty that has just been signed in March after 5 years of efforts, and the treaty that's going to impact 650 million persons with disabilities around the globe. And the third thing that I would like to do is to talk about where we go from here, because what's happening with the UN Convention is that many countries and many professional groups are now talking about implementation. And to implement such a global initiative takes careful planning, and it takes discussion, and the way in which it's being implemented, in my opinion, directly links back to your cultural experience. And so these are three very broad topics in a very short amount of time, but I hope to just give you little teasers, if you will, or kind of a potpourri through stories and information to help you see the big picture and also help you go toward your planning for the future, as are others. First of all, whenever you start to talk about culture, you need to understand who are the persons that are involved. And you'll see that culture, to me, is very, very broad. Culture represents my life experiences to date. It represents the persons that I interact with. It represents what I've chosen as a profession. And so I thought, in order to speak to RESNA as a society, or RESNA as a group, I took some time to go through this program to answer, who is RESNA? So who are we as a cultural group? Especially since our theme is building cultural bridges to improve the quality of life for persons with disabilities. I don't need to read all of these groups. You know who's in the group, who's in the room, and what we represent. But you can see, even by looking at who is RESNA, the breadth and depth of personal life stories and personal professional interests that we have in this room. So we have occupational physical therapists, speech-language pathologists, assistive technologists, and so forth. And we're going to have to work together in collaboration to begin to implement what's happening in terms of persons with disability. The other question that you ask is, what are the interests of RESNA? And it said, in our program, again, we're many disciplines, we're one family. So what does that mean? Well, look at the disciplines. Look at the topics that are represented at this meeting. They're pretty broad. And basically, what I would say in terms of what are our interests, we're really talking about our life issues. Those of you that are researchers or professionals, we're talking about what you've chosen, for whatever reason, to spend your life doing. I've had an amazing opportunity in January to be invited to serve as the new dean of a College of Health Sciences at the University of Indianapolis. So I left California after 17 years. I've just moved to Indiana. It was quite a shock in the winter. We had a terrible winter. I do miss California, I can tell you. But we're forming a new College of Health Sciences, and our foundation is a very distinguished, excellent school of physical therapy and a very fine school of occupational therapy. And those two groups, when they hired me, said explicitly, we don't want to be combined. And you know, with licensure and all kind of issues, OTs and PTs have distinct scope of practice. But yet when they get into rehabilitation, they work together. And I can tell you in the last 5 months, by beginning to work with them and by maintaining their distinct identities, but encouraging them to form now and think in terms of health sciences issues and where we may go, the culture of OT is very different than the culture of PT. Very different. And so I have to keep my point of reference when I know who's walking into my office and who's upset. And we just recruited 5 new faculty. They'd been doing a search for a while, and we were able to hire some superstars. And now there's the culture of the Midwest versus East Coast, West Coast. We can really start to see people's concern over our latest was musculoskeletal and biomedical curriculum. And so we're dealing with cultural issues every day. By studying culture, I think it's made me a better mother, it's made me a better parent, it's made me a better daughter. I really like a very broad definition. Talking about culture is talking about our life. And it's not just limited to different languages. It's not limited to different ethnic groups and so forth. Let me say also, the slides that you're seeing today, I'll upload to RESNA. I'm more than happy to send this to anyone. There are a few handouts that we sprinkle throughout for those of you that like handouts. So you can get the references, you can get the template that I'm going to introduce and so forth. But you're more than welcome to have any of the visuals that I'm presenting today. So if we think, where do we begin? I mean, how do I take all the topics that we're going to talk about this week at this convention and make some kind of sense out of it for you? How do I give you some kind of guidance, or how do we begin to have discussions that are meaningful? Well, again, going back to why one study culture? We study culture because it's about our life, as I said, from birth to death. Without an understanding of culture, we struggle with issues like separation, persons' behaviors. We have the sense of us versus them that we certainly don't want to have. We see feelings of emptiness. We see a lack of understanding of what each of our own identities are. So a study of culture is very, very important to us as professionals, providing services to consumers that may or may not have the same life experience that we've had. It's very, very important. Now, as I said, I have 3 topics to talk about today: a brief introduction to culture, and a little bit about the United Nations and what's happening, and then trying to pull this all together. I had the opportunity in California to work with intercultural communication experts that are well known internationally, and they wrote lots of books, and I saw them practice it in our department. There are a lot of terms that I think are very meaningful, and I'm just going to introduce three today for you to start to think about issues that you may face daily in a little bit broader way. The first term is attribution. An attribution is how we explain what we see, how we, based on our life, try to make sense out of what it is we're observing, and we attribute some kind of sensical meaning to what we see. I led a personnel preparation grant in California for about 6 years, and students would come into my office and cry and say, I can't be on your grant, because, and we had about 14 languages and lots of different life experiences matched together. And I would always say, you are doing exactly what I would expect you to do based on your life experience to date. But when you have more knowledge and you can make more choices, then you can change or broaden your attributions. The second term is becoming mindful. I like this term. If we're mindful in everything we begin to do, if we're in a state of mindfulness, well, what does that mean? It's a state where we try to give more distinctions, more alternatives, and we're open to new perspectives. Let me use an example right now. We have a superstar coming into physical therapy. I thought the faculty would be happy, and in fact they were happy, until we made the hire and the person is on her way. And now they're starting to think about how it may really impact their life. And so we try to, when we have discussions, they have an integrated curriculum. And I thought another person to help with the curriculum would lessen the load. I thought another younger person with a different experience coming in would enhance the quality of education for our students. But what I'm finding when we have these discussions is they're not yet in a state of mindfulness, and we're working toward that. The third term is cognitive complexity. And cognitive complexity refers to perceptual categories. And the more cognitively complex you are when you begin to think about cultural issues, the more perceptual categories you can assign. I like to think of it as having a broader repertoire. This is the first time I've been a dean. It's absolutely nearly ridiculous that they picked me to be their dean. But I know clearly, because my background is in speech science, speech language pathology. I really didn't know anything about OT or PT other than the teams I've worked with for years being in augmentative communication. But I was a safe pick, as I'm not PT and I'm not OT. And that's how I got the job. And every day they come to me, and it's incredible, because it's like, how can we make these decisions? But by applying this cultural framework, we're negotiating through, and we're really, it's interesting to hear even the staff talk about what they thought of PT or what they thought of OT when they counted the reams of paper and they didn't share consumables and so forth. And as we merge into health sciences, but keep this distinct identity. So cognitive complexity is to look at alternatives and to look at more explanations that we may be able to apply for meaning. So those are just a few definitions that I want you to keep in mind as we look at our practices in new and different ways, which is the template that we're going to end up with. Now let's go back to the resident interest. If you look at that, look at the different topics again. We're talking about empowerment. Well, empowerment, that word has a lot of different meanings for a lot of different people, depending on your audience. Ethics. Ethics is very, very culturally loaded. Legislation, what the United Nations did was they outlined a set of ideals and principles. How those are actually be enacted into policy, we'll have to see. But the resident interest, we want to be mindful as we go through this week about our planning and working with persons with disabilities, or providing better clinical services, or manufacturing, or looking at universal design or other kinds of options that, or issues that, that those of you who are very, very different in this audience may need to think about. Let me give you a relatively simple example of cultural topics from the field of AAC. And I apologize, I'm very, very dry today in Arizona, so you're going to see me drinking a lot. There was a qualitative research study looking at practices with regard to Mexican-American families. And they ask a bunch of questions. And the outcome of those interviews with families were, well, the perception of the augmentative communication devices, the use of it, isn't the same as when we talk to each other through speech, even if the augmented communicator is a proficient user. Well, you probably expect that. We all would rather probably have speech as a preference if we could, but some people don't have that as an option. The Mexican-American families reported that technology was still very mysterious and complex. Again, some findings. What do you do with that as a clinical service provider? What do you do with that awareness? How can you make it less mysterious and so forth? The language of the device is a barrier at home. In the home, they'd still prefer Spanish as the language and not English, and the devices they were given were predominantly English. The family, especially Hispanic Latino culture, wants a more intimate, more personal connection. The device gives a sense of distance connections. And they also found when they were having conversations that when they sat down and did their planning for next year for the IEP meetings and so forth, that there was a real disconnect, that the families were hearing one thing and the professional was actually giving guidelines and information another. So those are some cultural examples. But let me show you and talk to you a little bit about a bigger, broader cultural phenomenon that I want to introduce you to. And this is the culture of disability by society. I've talked with a lot of persons that have disabilities, and they argue, is there a culture of disability? Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But certainly in Smart's book, she made some very important points that I want to share with you today that I hope that you keep in mind. And that is, predominantly, persons with disabilities have to follow the norms that have been established by persons without disabilities. And that's a real important construct for you to be aware of. Let me just read a little bit. The disability experience is known to be directly linked to the society in which the individual resides. Family beliefs about causes of disabilities are cultural. We know there's an area called healthcare communication or health communication. We know that persons will not seek medical care unless Some individuals won't seek medical care unless there's a member of their community there. We know there's a severe shortage of occupational physical speech pathologists in the health professions. And so we know that members of various communities may or may not be seeking care because they don't see one of their people there. They don't see somebody like them that they can relate to, and they may go to alternatives. If practitioners are unaware of the society values with regard to disability, it's most likely you're going to select clinical strategies that may discriminate and they may create stigma. And you don't do it on purpose. You do it without knowing, without an awareness. Now, as I said, the rules and expectations for persons with disabilities are established all too often with persons without disabilities. Disability is a normative experience. This is probably what I found most interesting when I was reading this text, and that is there's a stigma assigned to disability. There's a hierarchical stigma. And I had never had that awareness or that awakening until I considered this. Consider that if you have a disability that results because of a consequence of war or an industrial injury, this disability has less stigma attached by society. Because work accidents or injuries from war may be considered more noble. Isn't that interesting? I never thought of a hierarchy of disability. So I said, I love to study culture. If your disability resulted because you used alcohol or drugs, you did something stupid, or a failed suicide attempt, there's more stigma attached to disabilities resulting, and hence the services that are delivered, the way in which practitioners engage, and so forth, the stigma is manifest. So I want to give you some examples like this as I go through today, because these are clearly cultural examples. They're clearly normed by different communities. And depending on which country or state or society that you live in, you have different consequences. On the UN Convention that we're going to talk about briefly in a few minutes, one of the 50 articles is the right to registry. So some countries, at birth, if a child has a disability, the child is never registered. There's no birth certificate. If there's no birth certificate, if there's no registry, there are no social services that then that individual becomes entitled to. So there's all kinds of things that by participating in those conversations, I had these aha experiences to make me more culturally aware of what I, as a scholar, have selected and elected to deal with. Should we care about culture? Probably. It can link directly to our evidence-based practices. Certainly, it has a lot to do with clinical ethics, universal design, interpretive assessments. There's a special paper or two in here on cognition. There's a lot to do with assessment of cognition in the literature if you read it. Again, let me give you a couple of examples. Let me talk about ethics. And ethics isn't maybe one of the priorities at RESNA, but let me just give you an example of where it is. Consider the story of Alice. Alice was noted to have marked hypotonia, great difficulty in sucking as a newborn, and was found to have severe brain atrophy on a magnetic resonating imaging scan. Her abnormal swallow function led to a worsening of her nutritional status and bouts of respiratory distress. Alice's mother was a physician, and she was concerned about the future of her daughter with so much pain and so many surgeries. And so when Alice's pediatrician proposed a tracheostomy to protect her airway and a gastrostomy feeding tube inserted for nutrition, Alice's mother, the pediatrician in the hospital, refused to give consent. And the nursing staff were so upset with the mother, pediatrician, they took her to the hospital's medical ethics team. The team, after consultation, found that this family was loving and caring, even though it was their first child, and that the family's emphasis was quality of life was paramount. And all the parents wanted to do was protect Alice from the suffering and the painful medical surgical interventions. And so after extensive discussions, the ethics team granted the parents permission to remove services. Following the ethics consult, the parents refused all further intervention, took Alice home where she died a couple of weeks later. Now, in terms of disability scholarship, you can argue both sides. Was this decision right? Who has the right to make these kinds of decisions? This is an example of the ethical dilemmas for children with disabilities and possible clinical outcomes that persons are facing. The story reflects the rights of individuals with disabilities and the willingness to advocate for such rights, but also shows the right to limit aggressive, life-sustaining therapy. Now, I introduce this because ethics are increasingly reflecting cultural values. And the values that we carry with informed consent, medical rights of minors, withholding and refusal of treatment, and so forth, if you get into persons with mental retardation, sterilization, marriage, these are all issues of moral reasoning. Now, you may say, well, that's a little bit on a tangent, Mary, to talk with for RESNA. But I was asked to go to Italy, and talk to persons about implementing this United Nations Convention. And I went in my North American cultural life experience model, although I thought I was fairly experienced, having lived in California. And when I got to Italy, and when I participated, which was an amazing discussion because their whole style was different. A conference like this, even though you had a day and you had a time, we were kind of pulled randomly saying, why don't you go on now? And they had a radio station, and every few hours they'd say, this meeting is held at this hotel at this address, come on down. And over 3-4 days, people from the community with disabilities kept coming and coming. It was an amazing. But what I saw in Italy that I should have thought about it, but I hadn't, because it hadn't been my life experience, was there's no separation of church and state. And the impact from the Pope and that whole culture of that society was very different, the way they deliberate and their rights and the rights of citizens and so forth. And it became very apparent, again, of this cultural, societal influence on professional decision-making. So I want to share that with you because not only was their style sort of rhetoric and not debate and discussion and conversation, as I was used to, just the fact there was no separation of church and state was really quite apparent there. Now, what do we do with this? How do we link this to the cultural bridges that we want to have within ResNA and as we communicate and plan between ourselves? Well, let me switch subjects again. And let me talk about making some connections. So just in brief, how do you become more of a cultural human being? How do you become more aware? Well, there's all kind of cultural elements like death anniversaries, birth celebrations, looking at child-rearing practices. I was asked to write a paper on acquisition of culture. I thought, why do I get these kind of interesting topics? I always have to kind of rise to the occasion or feel like that ends my career on that day or that opportunity. But what was so interesting to me was that when I was looking at acquisition of culture, I had to go back to the beginning of time and look at child-rearing practices and the moment of birth and Are beings biologically cultural, or does cultural come first and then biology and all those kinds of questions? But what impressed me was one story where they talked about child feeding practices. And the fact that if the child is breastfed versus interval feeding, what the feeding on demand versus being forced to feed at intervals does to the neurological system in terms of suppressing or impacting its development. Just a fascinating discussion. I thought, wow, from the moment of the first breath and how the mother chooses to feed the infant, it's a cultural phenomenon. And that choice of feeding at intervals or naturally may impact that child's neurology or biology or how they evolve. So the study of culture, as you can see, is just fascinating. Not in the traditional sense of, oh, here we're going to go talk about cultural differences and all again. It's interesting because it gives me such insight. Now, let's change topics from culture and let's look at the United Nations Convention for just a minute. And we're going to have a session after this for persons that want to talk a little bit more about this convention than I can in this session. But over the last 5 years, persons from around the globe have come together at the United Nations. They had 8 or 9 ad hoc committee meetings, and they talked about rights for persons with disabilities. The reason that this convention is so important for all of us, and the fact that
we have to get it out in terms of media and everything we do, is it's targeted for 650 million persons around the globe. It has about 50 articles. Again, in my handout, you can read all the text of all the discussions. You can get a PDF file of the final convention. I'll be more than happy to give you as much information and detail. But what is so important about this convention is for the first time, the human rights group and the advocates for persons with disabilities united. And they literally surrounded the politicians. They sat behind them in the UN, and they shamed them into action. And they educated them, and the disability communities around the globe united in an international disability caucus. And they coined the slogan, "Nothing about us, without us." And it was absolutely amazing to see this take place over years and see the community come together and the politicians realize the tremendous importance for finally people with disabilities to have full rights for the first time in their history. Full rights to participate economically, to not be shut out of employment, etc., as we heard yesterday, and as we all know, full rights to participate in society equally, and to enjoy all the social benefits that everybody else enjoys that doesn't have a disability. Full rights culturally to participate in cultural events. So it's an amazing document. And on the first day of the signing, which was on March 30th, 83 countries came forward and signed. Now the United States wasn't one of those countries. And you have to ask why. And other countries are looking to the United States, the American with Disability Act and various acts, for models. And they're emulating the policy, the legislation, what we already have enacted. And they're looking at a lot of examples, but they're moving forward. And they're moving forward from a governmental perspective, and they're having these series of implementation meetings all the time. And the European Union is it started in Italy, that group, which was Luca Soni Association, a gentleman that had ALS who's since passed away, but advocates for his life work. People are starting to implement the full right for full participation with others equally for society. And that's why it's such an important document and for persons to be given a voice. Knowing that persons with disabilities and their families and peers and everyone has an equal opportunity to make a valuable contribution to their society. Now, I was privileged to participate in getting some of the language of augmentative alternative communication written into the language of the document. And it was before Augmentative Communication. ISAC was a non-governmental organization, so it was a great honor for other groups to include us, the World Blind Union, World Federation for the Deaf, and Landmine Survivors Network, and so forth, allowed us to have our language and our interest written into this. The articles for AAC are in the definitions, Part 1, Article 2, and again, I can give you the full text. That's not really the purpose of this morning. Article 21, freedom of expression, and Article 24, in terms of education. And I looked through these 50 articles because, again, this plenary session is not just about augmentative communication. That's one part of it. And I thought, which of these articles may be relevant for RESNA members? And these are the articles that I think that may be of most interest. And again, I have the convention with me. I have the full text, and you have it in the handouts that were distributed through here, and I'm more than happy to give you the website for this, but awareness raising, accessibility, access to justice, living independently, personal mobility, work and employment. It's an amazing document. And what it is right now is just a set of ideals, just like all men are created equal, and then from the Constitution we developed our laws. This is just a set of ideals. And countries around the world and groups are now putting this into practice, putting it in some kind of policy. So I bring it to RESNA's attention because many of you can be very instrumental in North America and beyond in helping people see this to its full conclusion and full inclusion for persons. Now, I want to give one example, and that's the access to justice. Just again, for point of information, my personal experiences. When I was in California, I was invited to do an augmentative evaluation for a legal case. And I readily said yes. And I said yes too readily, but it sounded interesting, and I'm always looking for things that are a little bit out of the norm because that's the way I'm genetically wired. So I said yes. I didn't realize that I was involved in a court case that had been going on since 1992 and that there were many augmentative communicators. The attorney had not volunteered that information until I agreed to be an expert witness. Very briefly, access to justice is such an important article that they pulled it out as its own separate article, because do you realize how entrenched in the oral tradition law is? If you can't speak, you're pretty much out of luck. Can't be deposed, can't give testimony. And so when I got involved in this, there were several persons in California, and their caretakers had bought these light tech devices and programmed them, and so their caretakers had given them all the language and messages that they could then say through these devices. Okay, so it was pretty complicated because you had to determine, first of all, whose message was it, and secondly, did they really have the cognitive skill to say the messages they were alleged to say? And the caretakers, of course, wanted them to say these messages because it involved a bunch of professionals and schools and jurisdictions and courts, and it was quite interesting, and I found myself in the middle of it. And there was no legal precedent for communication capacity in the law as yet. And in order to be an expert witness, and in order to introduce testimony or an assessment into the legal system, at least in the United States, you have to meet the standards of something called the Daubert case. And the Daubert case has four criteria which have to be met. And one of those is you have to use an assessment tool that's widely published and recognized and standardized, and it's agreed upon that everybody uses. That's not in augmentative. And then as I started to call all my peers and ask for help, and you can't disclose too much, but I thought, here we go. Again, I'm going to lose my job or be kicked out of the profession or advance. And I bought all these CDs and DVDs and learned about being an expert witness and so forth. Then it dawned on me, if we could meet the standards to evaluate children's communication capacity, and if the legal system would allow that, when you introduce assistive technology, that threshold of competence shifts. So then you have to do a second assessment because of the result of the assistive technology. You see that? So it goes on and on. An amazing experience. Then I also learned that the insurance companies have the right, and you have to write the reports really differently, because if you say anything like I would say clinically, to hedge maybe, probably might, it introduces reasonable doubt. So everything you say has to be said with a degree of medical certainty. And the lawyers really only want to know, do they have a 50% greater chance of winning their case? So just the part about access to justice is amazing around the world as we look at persons who want to have opportunities. And that's just one little example that I was very involved in as we went through this. Now, the last part of this speech is, what do we do with this kind of information? You know, you kind of realize that culture is very important, and there's a lot that's happened now with policy and change and regulation and excitement around the world. But what does that mean to us? What does that mean to us as professionals? How do we put this all together and begin to move toward the next step, which is implementation, planning, discussion? Because these are really, really big topics. And we typically don't have to deal with anything so broad and vast. So as I like to do, I Google and I read, and I thought, what kind of a framework might I recommend to my peers so we can start to have discussions? And I found a 6-part framework from an employer's forum on disability, and they actually called this 6 building blocks. I changed it a little bit. And they said these are building blocks in business to include persons with disabilities, because if we include increasing numbers of persons with disabilities, business practices will benefit. Well, I like this building block concept, so I offer it to you today as a template. And let me go through it really quickly because we're running out of time. Strategic benefits refer to how disability affects people, how different people experience disability, and the way they choose to use technology. And this building block reference is on the reference list. You can read it in full. Societal benefit talks about the disadvantages perceived or experienced by the community and the individual. Ethical benefits focus on the values of a society, or doing the right thing, or reflection about what we're doing. Legal benefits focuses on being in legal compliance, issues of discrimination and protection, issues of legal risk. Professional benefits focus on human potential. Myself as a professional, service provider, what's the human potential of an individual for whom I may provide services? How can I enable this individual to fully participate in society and have society benefit by that participation? And the final one, the personal benefit, focuses as we begin to talk and deliberate and plan that every person, disabled or not, some disabilities that are visible or not, have talent. They have relationships. They have reputations. They can have satisfaction, and we can look at productivity and all these kinds of things. So this became the beginning of a template that I started as I'm asked to talk about the UN to say, how might we apply this and start to have little discussions? Well, it gets pretty complicated, and I'm going to flip through some of these, but 75 countries worldwide already have policy for discrimination. Disability is a rights issue. It's a natural part of human life, so we need to build a more inclusive approach. What I want to talk about on this side, Lou Gulliger, the economics of AAC, talking about speech-generating devices. There was a report where he costed out that if all insurance policies could put speech-generating devices in, it costs about 2 cents. And he compares it to the cost of one bite of a muffin. Not a muffin every day, one muffin a year for a quarter. So when you argue globally the economics and all of this, it shows how ridiculous we have been in denying and not having this inclusive approach. Now, what does that mean for a group like ResNA? We have the 6 building blocks. But then we also have professionals, manufacturers, policymakers, and so forth. When you put these two together, you get a template that I offered you that looks something like this. And so you can sit down and say, persons with disabilities, strategically, what might that mean? In other words, you can take it block by block, because if not, it goes like, oh, Mary, now you lost this. It's way too complicated. But you can use this template, and these are just some examples. You could fill in whatever words in the boxes that you want, but I only offer it to you as some examples to begin the next stage of discussion. And for example, if you look at persons with disabilities, and you look at each of the 6 benefit factors, and you led discussion groups around that, you could, for example, say, For society, if you include persons with disabilities, there'll be greater inclusion. if you look at personal benefits, there'd be greater opportunities and satisfaction. So you can go block by block. And it's not my point again to go block by block with a group this size, but to offer this to you as a planning template. Does that make sense? Where you sit down in small groups and you only take the column and row that's of interest to you, not the massive. I just tend to do things on a global scale because, again, that's sort of the way I was genetically wired. But if you look at another one, let's look at manufacturers. And if the manufacturers, and you can't quite see this with the lights on, but if you look at the legal risk or the element of compliance, then the physical design is impacted by that. If you look at personal talents and benefits, then you start to see IT design that reflects, because of the awareness of personal issues, more accessible websites. So is this kind of making sense? And you can plan and have a dialogue and go through this as a discussion. And I won't talk about more of these because we're running out of time, but each box can be a template for the next stage of discussion with regard to implementation. And I offer it that way. And again, people can have this template. So what does that mean? The United Nations asks everyone that's involved to have more awareness through the public and through the media. And that's what this speech today is about. Advocating for greater awareness for what's happening. These are all the resources, the websites from a lot of this source material that you can have, so you can read it all yourself and go in detail. You can't read it now, it's too small. I violated all the rules of making a PowerPoint, but know that you can have it. You can download it. I'll send this to you. You can email me. But what does this mean for RESNA, for our future directions, our initiatives? I would challenge RESNA, with your broad interest base, to do collaborative teaming, which begins at this meeting and continues on. And with our theme, many disciplines but one AT family, with that theme, we should be able to build strong bridges between our various professions and interests to help further improve and continue to improve the quality of life for persons with disabilities. I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary, for your really excellent and informative presentation. I want to apologize due to some apparent misunderstanding. You do not have the handout she was referring to. Those are probably at the workshop. But we'll put a notice up about how you can get them on the corrections board in the lobby. So we'll get that to you or make them a site where you can get them. And then on behalf of RESNA, we'd like to offer you a small token, and we really welcome your presence here. And for those who want to continue the discussion that she just hinted at in MacArthur 2, the next session, you can join her and others to continue that discussion. Now, don't go away, because we have an awards presentation briefly, and then also I have some usual housekeeping announcements. So thank you again, Aaron.
Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Dave Jaffe again, and we're going to have a short award ceremony. Will the following people make their way to the stage? Jamie Noon, Tina Rossler, and Susan Johnson Taylor. So the awards this morning will be two certificates of appreciation. Can you cue my slides? Okay. Okay, great. Certificates of appreciation are awards recognizing a RESNA member or non-member for a special one-time activity benefiting either RESNA or the fields of rehabilitation or assistive technology. And the awards this morning go to individuals who are concluding their terms as SIG and PSG chairs. SIG chairs coordinate the efforts of their SIGs as they address issues relative to their specific areas of expertise. They also play an important role in defining the conference content by soliciting instructional courses, workshops, and paper submissions. And PSG chairs organize their activities and focus on topics specific to their profession. And this often includes difficult and long-term issues such as standards, credentialing, and certification. At this time, in recognition of the continuing efforts and past contributions, I would like all the current SIG and PSG chairs to stand. And we'd like to thank you for your efforts this year. I also want to remind you of the SIG and PSG open house this evening, starting at 6 p.m. in the exhibit hall. This will be an opportunity for you to get acquainted with all the activities of each of these SIGs and PSGs, and for resident members to sign up at no charge with the SIGs and PSGs that interest them. So at this time, we'll start with certificates of appreciation for outgoing SIG and PSG chairs. I guess Tina isn't here. First one goes to Jamie Noon for his efforts as SIG 17 chair. That's the International Appropriate Technology SIG. Jamie. Tina Rossler is apparently not here, although we thought we had a sighting of her earlier this morning, but apparently she's not here. She is the outgoing PSG 2 chair representing the physical therapist, and we will mail her certificate to her. At this time, since Susan isn't going to be around on Monday evening, we would like to give her award. That's Tina. And the Distinguished Service Award recognizes RESNA members for their sustained contributions and service to the organization. Susan Johnson Taylor will be given this Distinguished Service Award for her continuing contributions of experience and wisdom in serving on the meetings committee and coordinating the instructional course program over the past 6 years. I'd like to read a little accolade provided by Ray in his nomination of her, and I think it's significant. Susan has devoted a significant amount of time and energy to RESNA over many years, evidenced by her receiving her first Distinguished Service Award in 1991 and being selected RESNA Fellow in 2005. However, she has not rested on her laurels, but has continued to work to pull together the instructional course program, a key part of the annual conference. Not only has she worked to build it into a strong component of the conference, she has also maintained an interest in other aspects of the conference planning, contributing her ideas and energy towards our implementation. This contribution of her experience and wisdom has provided important support to the various meetings, committees, chairs, that she has served under. Ray, thanks for that accolade, and Susan, thank you for your contributions. Okay. That's it for now. There'll be some more awards tomorrow. Thank you.
Okay, so before you move on to the, I think there's some refreshments out in the hall. To let you know that the refreshment breaks for today and tomorrow, in the mornings they're going to be in the building here, but in the afternoons between 2:45 and 3:15, they're going to be in the exhibit hall. And again, a reminder, the exhibit hall is open from 12 to 4:30 today. Lunch will be offered there. I think there's a charge, but hopefully modest charge, from 12:30 to 1:30. And again, encourage you to spend as much time as possible in the exhibit hall. The poster papers are going to be up during the lunch hours. There's the passport to prizes. Again, there's some great prizes up for grabs. So you all should have gotten that blue card in your tote bag. If not, there's some at the Resna booth in the exhibit hall. Go to those vendors who've contributed prizes, get a sign off, and put your names in for the drawings. One more time, check the board out in the front lobby that says program changes and announcements. We're working on it's getting a little cluttered with everybody else's announcements, but check carefully for the program changes so you don't go to a room and find you're in the wrong place or that your session has been moved. And last but not least for many of you, the CEU code is 7784. And tonight we have our wine and cheese reception beginning at 6 o'clock in the exhibit hall. And after time for we have our developers forum from 7 to 9. We have our SIG open house. And then we have our ice cream social, not to be missed, at 9 o'clock. So have fun.